Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
The United States is never going to be credible in terms of promoting democracy and human rights in the Middle East as long as it's supporting Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. I think it really just boils down to that simple fact.
Josh Rubner, the National Advocacy Director for the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, joins us to look at U.S. and Israel policy toward Palestine. A slight opening, maybe for change, in Washington, D.C., after Israel decides to stand down from some of its restrictions on goods and building supplies into Gaza. Israel now under pressure from rights groups, including ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. ICRC has called on Israel to end the blockade set up in 2006, which they say is illegal and causes dire health and basic living conditions for civilians. For rights groups, the crisis has long centered on what they call collective punishment of civilians in Gaza because of the 2006 election that brought Hamas to power. Retired U.S. military colonel Anne Wright.
The Israeli government, the Egyptian government, our government, European Union governments had all decided that they were going to put the squeeze on the people of Gaza in order to make the people of Gaza change the government of Gaza. And if you remember back in 2006, there was an election. Parliamentarians were chosen from a political, social, militant group called Hamas, a group that the United States and European countries and Israel says is a terrorist organization. But it was the organization that the people of Gaza voted for because they felt they were not having any real representation by the Palestinian Authority, and primarily the Fatah group. And so they voted to have members of Hamas represent them. Well, that caused big trouble for them because they crossed the line. They crossed, oh gosh, democratically they crossed the line. They had a democratic election, they elected some people, and other people didn't like it, like the United States government. You know, it's really remarkable. Here we pride ourselves, you know, we're a great democracy, and Israel says it's the only democracy in the Middle East. And yet what do democracies do when other people have democratic elections, but the democracies don't like it? Well, they squeeze the life out of people to try to get those people to overthrow the government of Hamas. So that's really what this blockade and quarantine is all about, is to put such stress on the people of Gaza that they will say to Hamas, get on out of here. We don't want you anymore. We'll put up with somebody else.
Retired U.S. military colonel Anne Wright spoke to an audience in Hartford, Connecticut last week at an event sponsored by Pacifica affiliate radio station WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. The event, held at Hartford Art Gallery Real Art Ways, was about the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Wright was on the flotilla that was attacked by Israeli commandos. You can listen to the entire program online at whus.org. Josh Rubner, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's an interesting week in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in meetings with President Obama. The Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu in the background demanding apologies from Israel for the deaths on the Mavi Marmara, the flotilla. And a surprising story from Mark Perry. Behind-the-scenes discussions going on at CENTCOM that Hamas and Hezbollah maybe shouldn't be isolated from negotiations. Mark Perry's source at CENTCOM scoffing at Israel's portrayal of Palestinians as linked to al-Qaeda. Now, this part of Israel's defense, of course, in defense of their attack on the flotilla. Just bring us up to speed on your organization's views.
We've been concerned from the outset of Israel's attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla that the U.S. would act to shield Israel from any form of international inquiry or any form of international sanction as a result of its illegal actions on the high seas. And unfortunately, what we've seen from the Obama administration up to this point confirms those fears, and it's acted in a way that has supported a domestic Israeli inquiry at the expense of an international inquiry into Israel's actions.
And we've heard that the Israelis agreed to allow two international observers, but that they're not terribly acceptable in terms of their status because of existing ties with, let's say, pro-Israel individuals like former ambassador to the UN John Bolton, for example, and a recent initiative called Friends of Israel, that at least in terms of Lord Trimble.
Right. I think it's outrageous that the Obama administration would pretend that Israel is capable of policing and inquiring and punishing itself. I mean, if you compare and contrast the Obama administration's response to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico to its response to Israel's attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, you see that there's a huge inconsistency. Can you imagine President Obama saying that BP can investigate itself? Absolutely not. It's been turned over to the Justice Department to investigate. So similarly, Israel cannot be expected to credibly investigate and punish itself for what was approved at the very highest political and military levels to begin with. There needs to be an international inquiry into this incident.
What about the role of Congress? I don't understand exactly what's going on, but we keep seeing these letters circulated and hundreds of members of Congress signing them.
It's true that Congress has played a expected and very negative role in responding to Israel's attack on the flotilla. There were Dear Colleague letters sent to President Obama and to Secretary of State Clinton, basically asking the Obama administration to shield Israel from any consequences for its actions. And the Senate actually passed a resolution about 10 days ago condemning the international humanitarian activists on the ship for provoking the incident, in essence, you know, blaming a rape victim for the rape, in essence, and trying to justify Israel's illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip. So, unfortunately, Congress is still stuck in a very old, tired way of thinking about Israel-Palestine that really bears no relation to reality on the ground.
We haven't seen much about Israel and Palestine consistently, really, in the last 4 or 5 years of reporting, I'd say, unless something like this happens, and unfortunately, then it lands in a vacuum. What kind of challenge does that present for the campaign?
That's very true, and I think especially in terms of the way the Obama administration has dealt with this issue, it came into office saying that it wanted to put this issue on the front burner and resolve it. And I think that President Obama and his foreign policy team did have a very realistic assessment that the goals that it wanted to achieve in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the region in general could not be achieved without resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think they understood that very well on an intellectual and even on a policy level, but that hasn't translated into any coherent strategy for dealing with this issue. And I think that after having been burned by not being willing to exert the political capital necessary on Israel to get a freeze on its illegal settlements in Palestinian territories, that President Obama has been content to let this issue go from the front burner to the back burner and to deal with it exactly like you said, in a crisis management form, and only when there's a problem that demands immediate attention to do a very short-term crisis management strategy. And that's definitely not a coherent policy strategy for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Now we have Prime Minister Netanyahu coming to Washington, D.C. this week. He'll be ostensibly discussing whether or not they can forge ahead with negotiations, peace talks. That's at least what the headlines are telling us. What do you think about those headlines and what could really be happening as Netanyahu arrives in D.C.?
Initially, this meeting was set up for the day after Memorial Day and the day after Israel's attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, and it was designed to kind of smooth over the very public policy differences that had arisen in March as a result of Israel's very open defiance of Vice President Biden's visit to Jerusalem and Israel's announcement that it was expanding settlements at that time. So Netanyahu's last visit to the White House was very frothy. That was back in March as part of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee annual conference. So the initial meeting was designed to kind of smooth over those differences. We'll see if this post-flotilla meeting will smooth over those differences in private or not. I don't think so. I don't think so at all, because the fundamental policy differences between the Netanyahu government and the Obama administration still remain.
And we're seeing from Mark Perry's story a bit of movement in the direction of change. You know, an unwillingness of the officials he talked with to go out on a limb and say that there's a policy shift, but they are looking at the downside of keeping Hamas and Hezbollah out.
I think that that's a very clear indication that CENTCOM views Israeli military occupation and Israeli intransigence and the Obama administration's unwillingness to leverage pressure on Israel to resolve the conflict as an impediment to its broader military and political designs for the Middle East. I think the thing that differentiates CENTCOM and the Obama administration is that CENTCOM doesn't necessarily have the same kind of political pressures that are being exerted on the Obama administration and on Congress that keep the policy the way it is. And that's probably the reason why CENTCOM is able to think outside of the box on some of these issues.
Well, too, we have to look at the timing of Mark Perry's piece coming as it did June 30th, just before the holiday weekend began, and consider that at least it's possible that this is the Obama administration's way or CENTCOM's way of introducing a topic that they can't introduce out loud verbally.
That's a very plausible explanation, and I wish I were a fly on the wall in the meeting between Obama and Netanyahu to learn what they were really talking about.
Well, I'm curious about the Israeli government's decision to put Lord Trimble on their internal panel investigating the flotilla deaths. We learned pretty quickly that Trimble had just met with a new group, Friends of Israel, both the U.S. and Israeli right represented there, including former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton. Why do you think Israel saw a need to set up yet another sort of international information damage control group?
I think it is a token of the desperation of Israel's supporters. I think they see Israel's standing in public opinion in international arenas going dramatically downhill. I think they are witnessing the substantial growth of an international movement to engage in boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, a la what was done against the apartheid regime in South Africa. And I think they're starting to grow extremely worried by these developments and setting up new organizations, new networks, to try to gain control of the discourse, really, to me, is a sign of their growing frustration and inability to really control the terms of the debate, which is always the first step towards policy change.
We're seeing, perhaps, too, recognition by this administration and the military that they have to mature in their policies, or they're just never going to disengage or disentangle in ways that are necessary to keep moving forward, and they can't afford politically or otherwise to move back.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that goes back to what I said at the beginning, that the Obama administration really does seem to understand at an intellectual level that the continued Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a major, major stumbling block to achieving broader policy objectives in the region.
Josh Rubner, explain why that is. You've been working in this area for so long, you know Congress well. Why politically is it a stumbling block, given all of the support that's obvious in Congress for Israel, you know, given the amount of money that the Israeli machinery, if you will, of information in America has to work with? Why are they concerned?
Well, I think a big part of it is explainable by the fact that the United States is never going to be credible in terms of promoting democracy and human rights in the Middle East as long as it's supporting Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. I think it really just boils down to that simple fact. And every single person in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, understands this. And I think growing numbers of policy circles in Washington, D.C. are coming to this realization as well.
The United States has other partners to consider. Let's talk about Turkey, because, again, Turkey threatening to cut off diplomatic ties. And their foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, has been saying that he will not accept anything less than an apology from Israel. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman saying his country has no intention of apologizing and sticking to the line that this was a hate flotilla, they were terrorists.
Right, and you know, Israel's behavior is increasingly erratic and increasingly self-defeating. If it was acting with any rationality, it would apologize immediately to Turkey, because Turkey has been, since the 1950s, by far Israel's strongest friend and ally in the Muslim world. And not only has it been a friend and an ally, but in recent decades it's become a strategic military partner as well, with Turkey buying billions and billions of dollars of weapons upgrades and weapons systems from Israeli military firms and so forth. And all those contracts are in jeopardy of being lost. So, you know, if Israel were acting with any sort of rationality right now, it would apologize to Turkey, but it's doing everything that it can, not only with this flotilla incident, but also purposefully embarrassing and denigrating its diplomats and so forth in recent years in different incidents that have really led to this crisis in Israeli-Turkish relations. So if I were a supporter of Israel and its policies, then, you know, I would have to be concerned about this erratic behavior, because it certainly doesn't seem that Israel is acting very rationally right now.
This is Israel's spokesperson, Mark Regev.
I don't want to get into a public shouting match with the Turkish government. The Prime Minister of Israel spoke on the weekend about how he wants not to see a continuing deterioration in the relationship, on the contrary. And I just assure everyone watching that the investigation going on at the moment is of the highest international standards and conforms with international legality and international norms.
And so, indeed, he sounds a bit reckless, perhaps, in his language, given that Turkey has seen 8 citizens and a young resident with U.S. citizenship killed recently, 50 wounded by gunfire, according to Anne Wright, who was just in Connecticut. So it's hard to see, though, how any of the current Israeli leaders are going to back down, given how strong their statements have been. And that leaves the most interested parties in the flotilla saying, you know, what about the facts in this case? Where's the independent investigation?
Well, I think that Israel is going to have to deal with the consequences and fallout of its illegal attack on the Freedom Flotilla for many, many years to come. There are already dozens of lawsuits filed in different courts against Israeli military and political officials for giving the green light for this operation. It's going to lead to increasing diplomatic tension with traditional allies and friends, and it's going to lead to the increased inability of Israeli officials to travel abroad without the possibility of having a lawsuit slapped against them.
We got a pretty good sense of just how serious the allegations are against the Israeli government and their defense forces when Anne Wright, the retired Colonel Anne Wright, came to Hartford recently.
There are reports from an Al Jazeera reporter who was standing up on the top deck near the wheelhouse, near the captain of the ship, that as he was up there and the helicopters were starting to come and starting to, the commandos were rappelling down on ropes onto the upper deck, that the man standing next to him all of a sudden slumped over and blood was coming out of him, that he had been shot from above. If that's true, then one can anticipate that other people that were on that upper deck saw what happened.
What about the overall response to all of this from the peace and justice community?
Well, in this country, we saw real outpouring of frustration and anger at Israel for its actions. There were protests in dozens of cities across the country. In some cases, some cities saw thousands of people out on the street. Just our organization alone sent about 10,000 letters to President Obama and members of Congress demanding both an international investigation and an end to U.S. support for Israel's illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip. And, you know, this type of solidarity and concern was replicated across the globe. In London, there were tens of thousands of people on the street. Israel's acting like a bull in a china shop right now. And the naked aggression and brutality that it displayed towards the passengers on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, I think, are just increasing proof and evidence that people need of really the brutality and aggression of Israel, which people saw a full dose of during its 2008 to 2009 attack on the Gaza Strip. And I just think that Israel's international reputation and image will continue to deteriorate as long as it continues to pursue these brutal policies.
And for years, we've seen rights groups complain that the embargo is illegal. But when the International Committee of the Red Cross does it, it sort of makes things a little stronger, doesn't it?
That was definitely heartening to see. And as an organization that was born out of the Geneva Conventions, the ICRC should be supporting the provisions of all the Geneva Conventions. And the Fourth Geneva Convention says very explicitly that collective punishment is a war crime and that no person can be punished for the acts of another individual, which is exactly, as Israel admits, is the reason for the blockade of the Gaza Strip, which is why it's illegal.
Just explain why this should be of concern to Americans, given the economic situation here and the enormous U.S. budget for Israel, including military aid from the Foreign Assistance Fund at times, for these aircraft and major weaponry.
Well, this is a key point, and this is exactly why people in the United States need to be concerned about U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine. It's not just a distant conflict. It's one that we're intimately involved with because we provide Israel with every conceivable weapon available that it uses to engage in its illegal military occupation of Palestinian territories and the kinds of horrific human rights abuses that were witnessed, for example, with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. If you go to one of our websites, which is aidtoisrael.org, you'll see that our support for Israel in the form of military aid comes at a price that we really cannot afford. $30 billion in weapons between 2009 and 2018. And if you go onto our website, you can look at your own town, congressional district, or state and see how much that geographical unit is providing in tax dollars to Israel and what that money could fund instead in terms of unmet domestic needs that we need to take care of here at home, such as affordable housing, green jobs, retraining, healthcare, etc. So we could think of a lot better ways to put our taxpayer dollars to than towards Israeli military occupation and apartheid.
For years, we've seen this problem that Israel is portrayed as the, quote, Jewish state, therefore criticizing it means criticizing the world's Jews. I think, though, that we are starting to see a strengthening of resolve on the part of American peace activists when it comes to Israel's tactics and behavior in Palestine.
Right. I think that the time when organizations such as AIPAC and the American Jewish Committee, so on and so forth, can claim to speak for the entire Jewish American community, those days have long since passed. It's very clear that there's a very open debate within the Jewish American community about both Israel's policies and U.S. policies toward Israel and the Palestinian people. And that division and that healthy debate is evidenced both with new liberal Jewish organizations like J Street, which vaguely support a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict but don't really have any firm ideas of how to get there other than to say to negotiate, to more human rights-based organizations such as Jewish Voice for Peace, which is a member of our coalition, which advocates for human rights and international law and really calling out Israel when it violates those things.
actually J Street appears to be more on the side of the Kadima party in Israel, whereas AIPAC might be said to come down on the side of Likud and the more rightist leaders in Israel today.
I think that's a pretty fair description of where the organizations would lie politically. I think J Street's important in that it shows U.S. politicians that AIPAC is not fully representative of the Jewish American community. I think, though, that its positions on particular pieces of legislation and its positions on policy issues leave a lot to be desired, quite frankly. And if anyone can figure out whether or not J Street supports Israel's blockade of Gaza, I'd like to know, because it's not at all clear from their communications as to whether or not they support or oppose it.
Tell us what your thoughts are finally about where we are with the Obama administration, possibilities versus maybe impossibilities, and then what political changes you're considering now that are going on as a result of the electoral process.
I think, quite frankly, that the Obama administration does not have a strategy in place, and that it's very much an issue that's on the back burner. And that from the Obama administration's perspective, if they can get another 2 to 2.5 years of peace and quiet on this issue without having to delve into it and put it on the front burner, that would be fine and dandy for them. And then if there is a second term, then maybe push it to the front burner then. But I think, you know, even in terms of President Obama's first term, it's probably now even getting a little bit too late to engage in a serious effort to negotiate an end to the conflict at this point, almost halfway through his first term, and preliminary, even indirect discussions haven't gone anywhere. So I think everything's really on the back burner, and everyone's just kind of waiting for the other proverbial shoe to drop. And I think what that means for civil society and for advocates of peace and justice, it's really a time to engage in campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel for its continued military occupation of Palestinians and apartheid policies towards them, because in the absence of politicians moving to enforce a just and lasting resolution to the conflict, civil society actors need to take it into their own hands.
Well, in that respect, what about the workout in terms of the blockade and the new items being allowed in? Is that a plus, or what do you make of that?
It's only a plus in the sense that it might do a little bit to relieve some of the dire humanitarian suffering that's taking place in the Gaza Strip, but it's definitely not a long-term solution. And even a slightly eased blockade of the Palestinian Gaza Strip is still an illegal blockade. So our organization is going to continue to press the Obama administration to really stick to its words that the blockade of the Gaza Strip is unsustainable, and really pressure it not just to tweak the blockade and allow a few more items in, but to really dismantle the blockade and put an end to this illegal act of collective punishment by Israel.
Josh Rubner, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. He's co-founder of Jews for Peace in Palestine, which merged with Jewish Voice for Peace and once worked for the Congressional Research Service. He has also run for Arlington County Board as a candidate for the Arlington Green Party. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for audio, discussions, and our Blogspot blog. Our music is by Fritz Heed.